of the 6 or 7 early published variations, a couple of them have 14 rather than 13 articles of faith. And I prefer the 14 because this is what it says about the Bible in that series of the articles of faith. You're all familiar with the one we believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it's translated correctly. Well, the word translated in there, of course, is the key. And I felt you should know some of the difficulties in the translation of Hebrew. And remember that the original Hebrew was oral language only, and that they had available the Babylonian cuneiform from about 5000 BCE and the hieroglyphic from about 3200 BCE. But Hebrew was not a written language until after about 1000 BCE when the Phoenicians invented the alphabet. And they were able to transliterate Hebrew using the Phoenician characters. And I have here somewhere a set of those, but apparently I don't have them on top, so I'm going to have to skip it. But to give you some idea, since they wrote this down, all they did was to use the writing as a memory aid. See, remember it had been all transmitted verbally from generation to generation. This is why so much poetry in the Old Testament, because the prophets were poets. They put their message in a poetical form. It could be remembered and transmitted. So when the writing was first introduced, they just put down a string of consonants. There was no vowels, no word separation, no sentence separation. You almost had to know what you were reading before you started in. So I chose seven consonants. See what I could do with it. I put different vowels. What have I got? 50 different words there. Well, what can you do with those 50 different words? It's rather interesting. Make up at least 10 legitimate sentences. In other words, from your seven consonants, you come up with a number of translations. Which one is correct, especially when you've got some that are contradictory? What's the correct translation? For thousands of years now, a couple of thousand anyway, some scholars have wondered about the authenticity of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, and have questioned it. They found that there were contradictions, things that happened long after Moses was dead. For example, the list of the kings of Edom. Moses was strangely sometimes referred to in the third person, and terms were used that Moses would not have known, and places were described where he had not been, such things as Moses spoke to the children across the Jordan. And there never was another prophet in Israel like Moses. The language also often reflected another time. The recurring phrase, to this day, suggesting that the account was recorded much later. Of course, for the first few centuries, any of the churchmen who questioned this had their books burned and they were excommunicated and imprisoned. Abraham ben Ezra says, if you understand these things, you keep quiet. There's other some interesting things in the first five books. Very confusing, such as the presence of doublets. Two accounts of the same event, often with different or even contradictory details. We have two accounts of creation, two versions of the flood, two accounts of the Abrahamic covenant, two versions of the naming of Isaac, two accounts of Abraham passing Sarah off as his sister, two versions of Jacob's journey to Mesopotamia, two accounts of the revelation to Jacob at Bethel, two of God changing Jacob's name to Israel, and two of Moses getting water from the Meribah rock, and so on. Most confusing of the doublets is the giving of the Ten Commandments, or the Decalogue, the Ten Words. It is impossible to produce a coherent story using all the information in Deuteronomy and Exodus about who went up the mountain and when and what was done there and who came down when and with what and what they found after they got there. The two accounts are impossibly mixed and contradictory. The generally accepted story is constructed from parts of the accounts, ignoring the discrepancies. One interesting account, similar to a doublet, is the flood story. Noah is given very specific instructions on building the ark and of taking in two of every living thing, a male and a female. And Noah follows these orders exactly. I use the word orders rather than instructions because the details are so specific. The directions are then almost repeated, but with a modifier. Of clean animals and birds, he is to take in seven pair. Again, Noah follows the instructions precisely, and this is quite emphatic. However, the next two sections, relating to the entry onto the ark and the ark's passenger manifest, state specifically that only two of a kind, a male and a female, of both clean and unclean animals, were on the ark. After the flood is over, the narrative is interrupted by an account of Noah erecting an altar and performing a burnt offering sacrifice of some or every clean animal and every bird. The soothing odor, a sweet savor being pleasing to God's nostrils. The narrative then continues with God's pledge to himself to never again destroy the earth. I have a strong suspicion that priests of offering burnt offering sacrifice in Jerusalem temple worship centuries later accounted for the altar sacrifice section, which then authenticated their practice. The story also had to include God's changed orders for Noah, otherwise he would have destroyed his breeding stock. Let's see if I skipped a page here or somewhere. Yes. All of these things implied multiple authors, or at least in the early accounts, two authors. And I wonder if I have... This is very important, these two, because in one of them, the J document, or Yahweh's document, is deity is always called J-H-W-H, or Yahweh, as near as we know. In later times when it was written, because this was a holy word that was not supposed to be said aloud, they put the vowel sounds of, was it, I believe, Adonai underneath it. And the Christian scholars who are not in on the know put the two together and came up with the non-word Jehovah. The second group of writing, deity is never referred to as Yahweh, always as El, or El Shaddai, the God of the mountain. Eventually, in the 18th century, a German minister, a French doctor, and a German professor began to assemble these pieces of evidence into a recognizable picture of the developmental history of the Pentateuch, a task finally accomplished by the German Julius Wellhausen, who lived between 1844 and 1918. In his book, The Ten Commandments, Dr. A. Powell Davies asserts it is because of the work of modern scholars, honest, patient, and rigorously disciplined, do we have genuine knowledge of the scriptures instead of ignorant surmises and interpretations based on superstitions. The two were put together, these two documents were put together in 722 when Samaria was smashed by Sargon and Israel destroyed. The priests had fled to Jerusalem, to Judah, And they brought with them their story. And so then we had someone who put them together, a third author, a redactor. And then the book of Deuteronomy, however, is totally different from any of the other four books. Style, language, things it talks about. It's related to Judges and the other things that came after. So it was apparently had a separate author. And then we, of course, have lots of priestly rules that are in Leviticus and Numbers that were added later. And we end up with probably five authors of the Pentateuch. It's interesting that when the sections that are attributed to the J author appear, the Yahwist author, were separated out and translated, they revealed a brilliant piece of writing, which Dr. Harold Bloom, the eminent literary critic, who is Sterling Professor of the Humanities at Yale, declared was written by a woman. Dr. Bloom, the author of some 20 books, including The American Religion, has read and studied all English literature, as well as all the religious books, or most of the religious books published by all the churches, including the LDS, as you can tell if you read his books. His reasons for thinking that J was a woman are in his book called The Book of J, which also includes a translation of the J material by David Rosenberg, a poet and translator, formerly editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society. Dr. Bloom felt that the writing was on par with that of Shakespeare and was so skilled that not a single word was used without deliberation and intent. He says that she, the author, would probably have been a high member of King Solomon's court, writing shortly after his death in 933 BCE when the kingdom had split in two. This was some 300 years earlier than the account written by the E, or Elohist, author. The blending of the two stories, of course, occurred much later, after the priests of Israel and Judah had, Israel had fled to Jerusalem. The section on the translation, I'm just going to skip over. As I say, I had some things of the showing, I guess I do still, to show you what was available and what some of the problems of translation are. I'm going to have to toss these on the floor, I guess. This is what the Hebrews had available to them. The first is, of course, your Egyptian hieroglyphics. Second is your cuneiform. This is what Hebrew looked like when they had adopted the Phoenician characters. And this is some of the squarish characters, the kind of thing that you see now as written Hebrew. With that kind of a background, I'd like to then go into the core of the paper, which is entitled The Garden in Eden. In this study, I have used six translations of Genesis, three Christian, the King James, the Smith Goodspeed, and the Luther, German, and three Jewish, the Tanakh, the T-A-N-A-C-H, that's the Jewish scripture. They don't like us calling it the Old Testament. David Rosenberg's translation of the Book of J, and a third one by Rabbi Elizabeth Sarah in her translation and exegesis in Women's Voices. After we leave the familiar grand six-day story of creation, you know, where man is given domination over everything on earth in Genesis 1:1-2:3, we bump into a much older, almost entirely different story of creation in Genesis 2:4. It begins with God apparently creating most everything in the day. And God had created the plants, seeds, and the herbs, but none were growing yet for two reasons. One, there was no rain, though God had caused a mist or a flood or flow to water the surface or face of the ground. And there was no one to till the ground, to dress it and to keep it. In other words, there was no gardener. As you'll notice as I tell this story, I'm picking up wording phrases from different sources here. Some of them are duplicates. So God took the Adama, a female noun, meaning earth or dust or dirt, and from it he makes Adam, or rather the Adam, earthling, a man. And he breathed into it, or him, since there's no neuter in Hebrew, there's no such thing as it, the breath of life, and made it a human, him, a living soul. Note, this is one of several play on words to be found in this J account of Genesis. In English, man can be either male, singular and specific, or genderless, plural and nonspecific. We can only guess which by the context. In German, the word is Mensch, a human. Hebrew, as I said, has no neuter gender. Most words are masculine, and that also complicates the translation. The Adam, the man, was first created, then made into a human being, a creature of flesh, quote-unquote, by receiving the breath of life into his nostrils. Since it was not good for the Adam to be alone, there's no proper name Adam till later, God seeks to find a helpmeet to bear him company. The Old English meet denoted independent equality and suitability. Partner is the nearest modern English equivalent. All the beasts and birds were brought to for naming, and that's in quotes, and because naming and apparently acquires a certain sense of getting power over and domination of something, it becomes your possession if you name it. But among them, there was still no adequate partner found for the man. I call attention to note the social rather than the sexual concern. After the creation of the woman, the man reverses this emphasis and assumes dominance with his flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones poem. God cast a slumber on the Adam, not ordinary sleep, more anesthetic, like Abram's vision-filled sleep, and he removed a tzeila, T-Z-E-I-L-A. This is a female noun in Hebrew meaning side or rib. In the Old Testament, its use is usually that of side, the sides of the ark, and Exodus, two references, sides of the cedar panel temple walls in 1 Kings, the side of the hill in 2 Samuel. So, since that has an interesting meaning, I thought I'd like to have you imagine a stick figure here and ask you, which side did God use to craft a woman to make an ish? From an isha, to make a woman from a man, which turns biology on its head. This is another play on words. This time it's possible in English as well as in Hebrew. So blind is the belief of many people in biblical literality that a man was assumed to have one less rib than a woman. By using a side, God fulfilled the need for an equal partner. The second creation from dust would have left woman eternally too, number two. This may be wrong, but the logic appeals to me. Man's historic and often barbarous domination of women is bad enough with the accepted view. There is among the Hebrew legends, of course, that this woman was Adam's second wife. Lilith was his first one, if all of you who are in on the know on that one. In Genesis 1:27, God, and this is there as a masculine plural, had created two sexes. A male and a female. The only trouble is our English male-female is apparently not equivalent to Zachar Nechiva. Rabbi Elizabeth Sarah delicately says these are symmetrical terms denoting anatomical differentiation for reproduction. Do you follow that? That's a bit too earthy to translate in public. God planted a tree eastward in Eden. And in the middle, he planted two unusual trees. One was the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, or righteous and evil, if you prefer religious terms. And two, the second was the tree of immortal life. The description of the waters flowing from Eden, forming four rivers, gives a most confusing picture of the garden's location, since Cush, or Ethiopia, and Hiddekel, or Tigris, east of Assyria, and Euphrates are wide apart. Translators have not been able to pinpoint the river Pison or the land of Havilah, where the gold is good, where it's precious, and where there's bdellium and onyx stone, which may be lapis lazuli, they still don't know. Location is impossible from this description. Now we have the man and woman in the garden, naked, smooth skin, that is, and unashamed. Enter the talking snake. Serpent is Latin, and snake is Old English. Both mean the same thing. The snake was smooth-tongued, more than any beast which God had made. And this is another play on words. The snake was Arum. Glottal stop on A-R-U-M. It should be here somewhere, but I don't see it. The people were Arumim. They were smooth-skinned. Unlike the beasts, the birds, they had no covering of hair, fur, scales, or feathers. The snake queries the woman about what God had said they could eat in the garden, and she recites the warning previously given by God to the man. But she modifies it a little. She adds it. She builds a fence around Torah, as the Jews would say. The woman then amplifies it. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Actually, this is another play on words, because in Hebrew it says, the day you touch it, death touches you. Somebody's having fun with words here. In other words, you become mortal. The tree is not a deadly poison. The snake fluffs off this death threat, but I like Tyndall's. He said, tush, ye shall not die. The English is, ye shall not surely die. Is coupled with the revelation by the snake, incidentally, that upon eating, their eyes would fall open, would be opened, and they would become like the gods, like heavenly beings, knowing good and bad. This is an interesting point here. It was the woman who had the insight, who saw, who realized that the fruit was good for food, eating, pleasant, or lovely, a delight to the eyes, and desirable as a source of wisdom, lively to the mind. So she eats, gives some to the man, and he eats also. And strangely, the immediate change was to acquire a sense of shame, according to the story, realizing that they were smooth-skinned. So they took fig leaves and made some sort of covering. And you can take your choice here, aprons, girdles, breeches, loincloths, so forth. Translators can't figure out what this single word means. And they hid. They heard the voice of God walking in the windy time of the day, in the evening, in other words, and I guess you should call it the breezy time of the day, calling to them. The obvious answer to God's query about how did they know they were smooth-skinned or naked produced the blame-shifting responses. The man doesn't come off very well here. He just says, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave it to me. The woman says, the smooth-tongued snake gave it to me, I ate. At this point, three obviously ancient poems are inserted into the prose narrative. The first is a curious curse on the snake. Crawl on his belly, eat or taste dust, endure eternal enmity with women, though the head bruising will probably be done by her male descendants. And note, this section is omitted in the earliest version of the Book of Moses. It's not there. The second and third poems are not so much curses. It would be the other page I don't have up there. Are not so much curses, they are statements of the hardships the two have bought by becoming mortal. The woman will in pain, groans that spread into groans, bring forth many children. Actually, the last of the poem in Hebrew seems to say, you will get pregnant a lot, for you will like coitus and want to be impregnated. The King James and other Bibles euphemistically blur the sexual connotations with your desire, your lusts, your verlangen shall be for your husband, for your man. It's interesting that the one translator, and incidentally the male scholars don't like this, in fact, Brother Wright says this was a horrible translation, but this was a woman rabbi's translation. To your man's body your belly will rise, for he will be eager above you. So much for ruling over women. It's odd that the King James in mid-sentence switches from a sexual theme to a patriarchal dominance theme, if you've noticed that as you read it. The ground is cursed for the man's sake. He will really have to sweat to wrest his living from the soil, and at death he will return to the dust from which he came. At this point, the gentle, compassionate, and paternal God makes clothing for them out of wild animal skins and clothes them. I get the picture of a father dressing his small children before they go outdoors to school. God here confirms the truth of what the snake told the woman, for their eyes were opened, they had fallen open, and they, like the gods, knew good and bad. The possibility then existed that they might reach out, take from the second tree, the tree of life, and become immortal. To forestall this, God banishes them from the garden and posts the cherubims, the winged sphinxes, with fiery, ever-whirling sword to block the path back. They were not driven out for disobedience. Read your story carefully. It was to preclude their taking from the second tree and becoming immortal. In chapter 4, Adam and Eve, or Hava, have become proper names, although there was an interruption of the man-woman narrative in Genesis 2, 8, and 9, where the Ish, a man, was called Adam. This probably was a later insertion, for the Genesis 1, 1 to 2, 3 is a priestly version composed or amplified some 300 years after the older Yahvist version was written. Subsequent LDS scriptures have informed us that Adam and Eve rejoiced, and this is the section, this is the original, and this is some of the thousands, hundreds of changes that have been made in the, since its original publication of the Book of Moses. Subsequent scripture has informed us that Adam and Eve rejoiced in their decision, and the fall, quote unquote, was an upward progression, a necessary step in eternity. The story is actually one of choice, of the exercise of agency, and was not the source of all subsequent human ills. As you can see, Adam blessed God, and Eve, his wife, heard all these things and was glad, saying we couldn't have had children and progressed if we hadn't have had transgressed. It was also not a sexual sin. At least I think it takes two to tango. And if you read your story carefully, Eve ate and she handed it to Adam and he ate, you know. But since St. Augustine had, especially among the clergy, has insinuated that this was a sexual sin and there made everybody's existence, since all arrive here through childbirth, the consequence of coitus, a sin-smeared one needing clergy or church assistance and control for remedy. And at last note, Eve's rather triumphant exclamation at Cain's birth, quote, I have gained a male child with the help of the Lord, unquote, or the boast This is another translation. I've created a man as Yahweh has. The jubilant tone, despite the agony of childbirth, is very obvious. Her second son was Abel. Abel became a sheep herder, Cain a sod buster, and the feud began. But that's another story, and not in Eden. I have here some copies, and you can help yourself to any or none or as many as you want of that basic core and go over some of the things which I mentioned. Thank you very much.
We're going to take questions together at the end. No, we have no moderator. And so we will be, Leonard will be our moderator for just a moment. Thank you.
I'm sorry I wasn't able to introduce the first one. This wasn't the one I was supposed to moderate, but anyhow, this is Jeff Needle. He is an Episcopalian Jew, and he knows about as much about all religions as anybody I've met. We've dealt with him for a long time in a study group which we have together, and he has a very interesting thing to describe. So,
I will say this, that when I was asked to do the talk, I submitted a title for it, and the title I submitted was Biblical Criticism in Early Mormon History. When the first draft of the program came out, the title read The Pentateuch. And when I got my program last night, it read Mormonism and Biblical Criticism. So I have come up with a new title so that there's absolutely no confusion. And the title of my talk is Pentateuchal and Hexateuchal Biblical Critical Scholarship in the Graff-Wellhausen Tradition and its Functional and Philosophical Coincidences with Early and Contemporary LDS Theology and Polity. And I hope that clarifies the matter for you. Strangely enough, much of what you heard from Lou was what I was going to cover, so we're going to do things quickly. I do coincidentally have a 3-page handout up front here which describes the JEDP progression that he talked about, giving some of the history behind it. You didn't know I'd have that, did you?
No.
Yeah. All right. Well, no. Oh, no. We're going to stick with the old, is what I think. One of the issues that I want to talk about is why even question the authorship of the Pentateuch? After all, we got along perfectly well for hundreds, if not thousands of years, thinking that Moses wrote the thing. Why even question it? Well, Lou brought up a few things about why it became obvious after a while that Moses really didn't write the whole thing. One of my favorite you did not bring up in Numbers, I believe it is, the statement is made that Moses was the meekest man who ever lived. And one must wonder whether the meekest man who ever lived would describe himself as the meekest man who ever lived. Like the Sunday school teacher who was given a pin for being the humblest man in the church, and then they had to take it away from him because he insisted on wearing it. There are two reasons, I think, why authorship of the Pentateuch is rather important. Number one, if you assume single authorship of this most important and most sacred part of the Jewish record, then you also can safely assume a single point of view. Unfortunately, when you read the text, you don't get a single point of view, you get many points of view. And it is because we have assumed that there is a single point of view, I believe this has translated into a church idea that if anyone challenges the official church point of view, there's something wrong with that. There's something difficult about it. When in fact, it is in the best biblical tradition to go against the grain, to go against the main point of view. So I think it's important that we establish, as Lou did, I think, in his talk, that there really were several voices spoken. The other thing that is important is to make note that even though there were dissident voices throughout all of Israel's history, they never varied from their commitment to the existence of the state of Israel and of being a people. They were Israel whether they agreed fundamentally in smaller points. Today, many churches believe that church unity can only be achieved if everybody is saying the same thing. But this is manifestly not true. As I was saying to Leonard just last night, I think I have discovered, as a non-Mormon, I have discovered the enemy. It's called correlation. My experience with correlation was calling the church one day. I was watching one of these videos that they give away on TV, and up came the old logo, which I like much better than the new logo, by the way. The new logo is dull. The old one was a little more interesting. And big as life, the tape came up and said, from the crutch of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, C-H-R-U-C-H. So I called Salt Lake and wanted to know what the crutch of Jesus Christ was. And they sent me to correlation. At that point, I didn't know what correlation was, but I learned that when you're questioning anything, you get sent to correlation. I knew immediately I wasn't going to like this organization. What I have done, and what I'd like to do as an exercise, if I could get two volunteers to distribute things on either side, I have printed out, let me give one for Lou here, I have printed out, first of all, the two accounts of the Ten Commandments. One, as you know, is given in Exodus chapter 20, and the other is given in Deuteronomy chapter 5. Tradition says that Moses wrote both of them. Scholarship tells us that this is absolutely impossible. And what I would like to do is put them side by side, as I have in the handout, and to examine the differences and see if we can determine why the accounts are different. Understand, by the way, that if you take the assumption of Mosaic authorship of both accounts seriously and as fact, then a mere 40 years or less separates the giving of the two accounts. But if you understand things from a more scholarly point of view and you accept the fact that whoever wrote Exodus 20 certainly did not write Deuteronomy chapter 5, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years separating the two, then the differences become more clear. One reflection that we might do to begin with is to think about what was happening in Israel in Moses' time as opposed to Israel hundreds of years later. You know, the nation of Israel really had its start with Moses, if you want to get technical about it, when they came out of Egypt. They spent 40 years wandering in the desert. And then, of course, Moses died and Joshua led them into the promised land. They divided up the land. Joshua died, leaving a power vacuum, which Israel's enemies took advantage of and began getting back. I don't blame them. You know, Israel, they were really a bunch of bullies, if you read the text. And now that they were separated into city-states of sort without a central power, they were weaklings. So the surrounding nations began getting even with Israel, and God raised up the judges. You read about them in the Judges to help protect Israel. After some 120 years, perhaps, of this, Israel finally decided they wanted a king. They anointed Saul the king. Saul was a rotten king. David was the second king. Solomon, his son, the third king. And then after Solomon's death, all hell broke loose. They had a big civil war, and the nation divided, and things went downhill from there. But one of the things that they did as a result of all of this change and all of this warfare, all of the problems that they faced, was that they became more concerned with national identity. The things that were important to them were important to them as a nation. Things had to be directed to them specifically. So looking at our Exodus account of the Ten Commandments, for example, skip down to Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8, the famous Sabbath commandment. Now, if you're not familiar with Judaism, the Sabbath is the central idea of the Jewish economy. Everything revolves around Sabbath. It is the distinctive thing. And in Exodus, we have the following commandment: remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, etc., and so on. And then the rationale given in Exodus for keeping the Sabbath is as follows in verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is. There is an appeal back to creation, to the creation story, or if you will, if I don't get people upset, the creation myth. It is an appeal back to that idea that justifies the keeping of the Sabbath. Now, look at the other column. Here we are, Deuteronomy chapter 5, 14. Chapter 5 and verse 14, the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. And then verse 15, the rationale for keeping the Sabbath changes completely. The idea of creation disappears. And suddenly we have, and remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. What became of creation? Whoever re-spoke the Ten Commandments decided to change the rationale for keeping the Sabbath. Now, why would that be? Why would that be? Imagine for a moment the Sabbath is the thing that identifies you, and the rationale given for keeping the Sabbath is something that applies not only to you but to everybody who ever lived. We all are the result of creation. By the time we get to the writing of the Deuteronomist, there is more of a focus on not what God did for the whole world, but for what God did for you. And so he drops the creation idea, because it applies to everybody, and substitutes something that applies only to Israel. It was only Israel who was brought out of Egypt, do you see? So here we have an amazing example. There's another subtle thing I want to point out to you, because there were other developments going on, particularly as relates to Israel's view of women. Down here in Exodus chapter 20 and 17, notice this marvelous thing. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Which came first? The house. And this, to a people wandering through the desert, had no houses. Go figure. Okay, it should have read, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's tent. But the word here really is house. But by the time we get to the Deuteronomist account, look what happens in verse 21. Neither shalt thou desire what? Thy neighbor's wife. The women didn't like being put in second place after the house. So when the Ten Commandments are retold, the order is reversed. So many things. When you get home later, look through these two lists. You'll find many, many differences. Every one of the differences between the Deuteronomy account of the Ten Commandments and the Genesis account of the Ten Commandments can be accounted for when you consider the growth and the self-understanding of Israel. Because as a people grow, as a nation grows, as a church grows, it must be in a constant state of redefining itself. It looks back at its history, and every time it tells its history, and every time even when it gives its laws, it changes. And these changes are a reflection of where a people have been and where they're going. And I think that this has profound implications to Mormonism. Think, for example, I don't want to get into this, the accounts of the first vision. Boy, oh boy. You know, if you put them side by side, you realize that if you were going to construct a strict, absolutely accurate account of what happened out there in the grove, you couldn't do it. And at least I wouldn't put $100 on my interpretation of this. And being Jewish, I probably wouldn't put a dollar on it. But what was happening in the mind of Joseph Smith? Was he just making it up? If you ask the Tanners, perhaps, they will say, here is absolute evidence that this never happened. Well, the Tanners never read the Bible. If you go back through the varying retellings of things in the Bible, you understand that your perception of what happened changes as you grow in your understanding of things. Now, Joseph Smith grew very, very, very quickly in his retelling of it. It didn't take 40 years. He didn't have 40 years to retell the story. But here it is in the Bible. I want you to see that the Ten Commandments are the most important thing in the Jewish life, with the Sabbath being the heart of it. And even with this, and you know, in Exodus it says that God wrote these with his own finger. Can you imagine the audacity of the writer changing something that God wrote with his own finger? This is better than the Book of Mormon. I mean, this is with your finger on the rock. And here the Deuteronomist turns around and says, yes, God wrote this with his finger, but we now understand God better, and we can go back and rewrite this to reflect how we've grown, you see? Enough of that. Another handout. Leonard knows how absolutely extravagant I am with my handouts. What I've done in the second handout, and we're not going to go through all of it, because we don't have time, and no reason to. You remember that Lou spoke about the different flood accounts, the two flood accounts. Well, I've separated them out on this handout. The first column is J's account of the flood. The second column is P's account of the flood. These are remarkably different stories, both practically intact. And I want to return to the theme of the two of each and the seven of each of the clean. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you. Let me pose a question to you. Can somebody give me an example of a clean animal that Noah might have brought onto the ark? Or how about an unclean animal? Well, sheep would be clean. What would be an example of an unclean animal? A pig. Okay, a pig would have been an unclean animal. Question. Since these divisions between clean and unclean didn't come up until the book of Leviticus, how did Noah know what was clean and what was unclean? Oh, he knew because he knew he wasn't supposed to eat it. Well, read later on in Genesis, mankind didn't even have permission to eat the flesh of animals until after the flood. Everybody from Noah on back was a vegetarian. So I ask the question again, how could Noah have known the difference between a clean and unclean animal? Did they have little tags on them when they came on? I don't think so. Well, in fact, the distinction between clean and unclean was not a dietary restriction, but rather an animal clean or unclean for sacrifice. And in fact, if you look at the word in the Hebrew for clean in this flood account and compare it to the Hebrew word in Leviticus, they're entirely different words. They mean two different things. One means ceremonially clean or unclean. One means dietarily clean or unclean. So we can accept the fact that old Noah would know what was clean for sacrifice. Down the left-hand column, Genesis 7:2. This is J's account. Take with you seven pairs of all clean animals, the male and its mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and its mate, and seven pairs of the birds of the air also, male and female, to keep their kind alive on the face of all the earth. Seven pair of the unclean, a pair of the clean, a pair of the unclean. Does P give that same count? You'll have to go to the second page of the handout, on the second column. P's account is much longer. Genesis 6:20, of all birds, just 6:19, of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark. Keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Go verses 20 through Genesis 7:11, and P seems to be hammering this point, hammering it. Two of every kind, two of every kind, two of every kind. What happened to the seven of every kind, of the clean? Why doesn't P talk about this? Well, P, if you remember, was the priestly writer. The priestly writer derives his authority from the Levitical priesthood, which wasn't around in Noah's time, according to the King James Bible, which is what he read back then, you know. This entire system of sacrifice that the priest derived his authority from did not exist in Noah's time. Hence, why would Noah care about which animals were clean and unclean? He wasn't authorized to offer sacrifice anyway. He wasn't a priest. So now we see a different thing. In our first example, we saw experience, we saw growth, we saw understandings changing the biblical text. Now we have something far more sinister. We have a hidden agenda. We have somebody looking at the text and saying, I can't say this because it doesn't agree with my theology. And we're not sure whether J added the seven or P took them out. I suspect P took them out so that there would not be any question on people's mind. And yet, when this editor, and this is really the point I'm trying to get to, when this editor saw these two accounts, do you think he was a moron? I mean, certainly he saw that there was a problem, that there was a distinction, there was some contradiction. He obviously didn't have Jerry Falwell's passion for harmonizing everything in the Bible. He looked at these two things, he saw two different voices, two different opinions, and did he make a decision, this one is going to go and this one is going to stay? No. He put them together. Why? Why? Because although the voices didn't agree, they were still legitimate voices in Israel. There was no thought that P would have to be called before some council and said, why are you saying this? This isn't what we said. The idea was this, that in the building of the Old Testament, especially in the Pentateuch, nobody cared whether there were contradictions. It simply didn't matter. What mattered was that the members of the community who had a voice and spoke their voice were all heard. And then we, as intelligent, reasonable people, could see and hear what was being said, hear what was being heard, and then decide for ourselves what it was that we wanted to be like. I do declare, and I'm not talking about Mormonism now, I'm talking about every religion, we sure go into a panic when we hear things that don't agree with our preconceived notions, except at Sunstone. Then you you expect to hear things. As I was heading toward the lunch table, I was telling Elizabeth, I passed a photographer. Did you notice there was a wedding going on there? I was a few minutes early, and the photographer asked me what kind of a product Sunstone is. What does it do? And so I tried my best from a Gentile point of view. And by the way, as a Jew, I love being with Mormons because it's the only place I can be a Gentile. I really appreciate being here. But I worked very hard at trying to explain to him what it was, and he said to me, you're not a Mormon. And I said, no, I'm not. Well, why did they invite you to speak? I said, I don't know. And he said, do you get booze? And what I heard was B-O-O-Z-E. And I said to him, no, I'm not going to do that while I'm here at Sunstone for 3 seconds. And for a few minutes, we got very confused until he made it clear that he was talking about B-O-O-S from here. Not yet. Thank you very much. There are times in any religious community. How are we doing on time? What time do we end? Are we doing okay with time? Oh, okay. We have plenty of time for questions and discussion then. It seems that religious communities anymore seem to get very upset when somebody stands up and says something that doesn't agree with the party line. There seems to be some insecurity about independent thought. I heard this story, it is apocryphal, okay, about the Mormon Sunday school teacher who was asking the children what they wanted to be when they grew up, and little Billy said, I want to be a doctor, and so that's very nice, and Sally said, I want to be a lawyer, and she said, well, that's okay. And she looked at Jennifer and said, Jennifer, what would you like to be? And she said, I want to be a prostitute. And the teacher had fainted dead and right out. And they revived her, and she looked up at Jennifer and said, tell me again what you said. She said, I want to be a prostitute. And the teacher said, oh, thank goodness, I thought you said you wanted to be a Protestant. Religious communities, the community of Israel had a problem when somebody stood up and said, I want to, in effect, destroy the community. I don't want to be a part of this anymore. I think the idea of the community is wrong. And then Israel took action. But when people stood up to voice their opinions, they even got their opinions in the Bible. It's really remarkable. When you think about the openness and the scope of what this redactor did, you understand the value of many voices. I am of the opinion, as an outsider looking in, that Mormonism is at a very critical stage, primarily because it is growing so darn fast. And the areas, you all know this is old hat, where it is growing most quickly has the least representation in the hierarchy. The hierarchy don't know what to do with it. On the internet, there was a discussion of something I had to ask about. My friends on the internet teased me incessantly about being stupid about these things. And I don't know, because I've never done any of these things. But they were discussing something called kava. And I finally found out that kava was some sort of intoxicating drink that missionaries in some remote islands run into. And in order to ingratiate themselves with the people, they have to go through this ceremony, which involves drinking kava, which leaves you snockered out of your brain. So they wrote back to Salt Lake to find out what they're to do about kava. And the opinion was that it was okay to drink it at ceremonial functions, but it was not okay to drink it socially. And the remark that came back was, man, don't you understand? Nobody drinks it socially. The only time you ever drink kava is at ceremonial occasions. So the folks in Salt Lake were telling the missionaries it was okay to get drunk as long as you did it at a ceremony. And this, I can guess that as the church grows more and more in remote areas, Salt Lake is going to have a harder and harder time understanding how to deal with people of different customs and different ideas. But the Bible writers never had that problem. If somebody stood up and said, this is my idea, somebody else said, great, let's put it in the Bible. Let's write it down. You see? I have become convinced, again, back to this, the idea of Mormonism, a crucial period. Mormonism reinvents itself all the time. All the time. And if you ever stumble across old Mormon books, as I do, and read them and compare them to new Mormon books, you have no question in your mind that Mormonism is reinventing itself. Who ever thought that the president of the church would be sitting on a rock with a Roman Catholic bishop on the front page of the church news? Who ever thought you'd see the day? I saw the day. And am I the only living subscriber to the church news? I don't know. Everybody I ask, nobody seems to know anything about this. But I get it. I think out of pity, because they send you these letters 6 months early saying, please send your money now. I think they're running short. But whoever thought we'd see the day? With each generation, Mormonism reinvents itself. Is that okay? Sure it is. It's fine. So long as all of the folks who are involved in the reinventing are allowed to be a part of it. The thing that I'm leery about these days is it seems that whenever somebody pipes up about something these days, there's always this, hush, don't say anything about it. Don't mention any names. Don't say anything. The future health of the Mormon Church, I believe, will depend upon not a single way of thinking, but a singular devotion to the exercise of the free agency that Mormons treasure so much, the ability and the freedom to speak up and to say what you want. I'm free to say whatever I want because they can't excommunicate me. I'm safe. Well, most of what I had to say was said by Lou, so that saves a little time. I do have, like I say, this handout. And I hope that you'll spend some time, perhaps, in the next few weeks with the Pentateuch, look at some of the things that are mentioned in there, and see in Israel's journey a reflection of maybe your own journey. I know I have been at a time when I have felt like I was in slavery, in bondage. And I have had times when I feel like I was brought out. And there are times I think we all feel that we are wandering around in the desert, maybe for 40 years. There are so many reflections to be had there. All right, well, thank you very much. And we'll... So let's open it up for questions, sure.
Questions? Yes. You're going to do a lot of this. If you're going to make that much, I can't repeat it.
Okay, looking at these two accounts, the one in Exodus and the one in Deuteronomy, we got the Yahwist account in Exodus and the D account in Deuteronomy. This just occurred to me as you were talking that when we get to this commandment about keeping the Sabbath day holy, and we have the rationale being creation. That's a priestly idea, I believe. That's from the priestly account. And so I'm wondering if we've got a priestly overlay on the Yahwist account here.
Oh boy, I'm of the opinion that that's the Yahwist account, the original telling of the Ten Commandments.
Actually, there are, I think, aren't there five, six, or seven different law codes? There's a list of curses, and then these two. Mm-hmm. There's several law codes in there, and the Ten Commandments are only two out of the lot. And if you look at them all, you can see an evolution in between them from the primitive, I think at least the primitive, the code of curses was the primitive one.
Well, I'm agreeing that this account is the Yahwist account. This Ten Commandments is the mm-hmm. Yahwist account. But I'm just wondering in this little part of it where we've got something that looks like it's coming from the priestly creation story, which is where God rests. Isn't it?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, okay. The creation stories themselves were part of the oral tradition of the people of Israel. All of the writers would have been aware of those creation stories. They knew them, and there were derivative stories too in other cultures. As you know, the Babylonians had their creation stories, and others did. So when you get to the point where the actual writing of the Ten Commandments takes place, I think it's virtually impossible to separate out, let's say, a priestly emphasis in the Yahwist account, since the Yahwist was absolutely certainly aware of and probably taught his or her children this same account, regardless of how it began.
But if the priestly account, with the Genesis 1 account, is written later, that's Genesis 1 is where we have God resting on Sabbath day,
that's
isn't
correct.
It? Okay, all right. And that's typically thought of as the priestly account of creation, mm-hmm. correct? Okay.
No.
Well, actually, the accounts were transmitted orally from thousands of years before. And the fact that they were written down with an time interval of about 300 years, that we know there was that much difference. At least I think we know.
At least that much.
It would fit the picture that you have the development of two different sets with different words for deity. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly find them combined, and it would fit the historical facts of the priests from Samaria fleeing to Jerusalem, carrying with them their oral accounts and their written accounts of, and so then a redactor blended or put them together.
Yes.
And maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah.
Say
well,
blend.
Let me clarify this about Genesis 1. First of all, E and P are very difficult to distinguish,
right.
Okay? Because they both use the word Elohim in their accounts. There is no reason to believe that Genesis 1 came from a priestly account because it doesn't involve any of the ceremonial ideas that the priestly writer would have been involved in. So it is almost certain that Genesis 1:1 through 2:4a, first half of the verse, came from
Elohist.
Yes,
right.
From the Elohist. That's
okay.
Correct. Okay? Let me turn that. Yeah, and let me make sure everybody understands the idea of the word myth. The word myth does not mean that something didn't happen. A myth is an accounting of an event which may or may not have happened, but which has meaning, primary meaning, beyond the historical event. And so when we look at the Genesis 1, can I do this real fast? Can I just come up here? I know we don't have the Bibles with us here, but if you look at the Genesis 1 account, I call this the creation myth because it is, in effect, a beautiful poem describing God's creative power. When you get home later on, look at this and notice the following, if you would. In the account, the problem faced by the deity is that the earth was without form, do you know the phrase, and void. And in the Hebrew, this is a phrase which is known as a hendiatus, which is a combination of words which together have a meaning that they wouldn't have separately. Like the phrase down and out gives you a meaning beyond the simple word down and the simple word out. It is a mental picture being given. Now notice what God does in order to solve the problem. Does anybody remember what God created on the first day?
Light?
Yeah, the first problem was that the creation was without form. So on the first day, he gives form to what is in the highest heaven, correct? On the second day, what does he create? The firmament, so he gives form to what's come next down, you see? On the third day, he comes down and creates the earth, the ocean, the rivers and the seas. So he gives form to what's on the earth. So now problem number one, being without form, is solved. What was problem number two? Void, empty. So on the fourth day, what does he do? He creates the sun and the moon and the stars. So he fills what he designed on the fourth day. He fills what he designed on the first day, you see. And then on the fifth day, he creates the birds, remember? So he's filling what he created on the second day. And then on the sixth day, what does he do? We have the animals and man. So he fills what he created on the third day. The poetic structure of this first chapter of Genesis is so obvious. There's nothing scientific about it. It wasn't meant to be scientific. It was meant to be a poem of praise of the wisdom of God in bringing this whole thing into creation. Now, is God the creator? Yes. But I call it the creation myth because by the time we get to the writing of this, there wasn't any need to convince Israel that God was the creator. What they needed to be convinced of was that he was a better creator than the creators that all the other folks had that they encountered in the wilderness, you see? And so this wonderful praise poem is written to show how our God is orderly and he's right and he's smart.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Now, wait a minute. That question, I think you better come and say into the mic so it can be recorded.
Well, do you want me just I can just repeat
that.
The question.
Okay, repeat the question.
The question was, how does the idea of Midrash enter into this discussion, and how might it reflect on understandings of the Book of Mormon? Is that correct? Okay, Midrash is the technique of developing stories and understandings which are largely mythological, but which become part of the corpus of knowledge of any religion. There is some question. We have an Episcopalian bishop, John Spong, who is convinced that the virgin birth is Midrash, which means that something happened. This woman had a baby, but then a mythology around the birth happened, and the story became what a core of Christian truth. You see, the Jews were especially good at the Midrash technique. We do not know how much of Scripture is Midrash. I have not done a lot of study on that. We certainly don't know how much of the Book of Mormon is Midrash. Okay? There is a sense, though, that if it is in the telling of stories that one grows, and I think this is the case, then it makes no difference whether the story is historically true or not. Because moral, ethical, and religious truth, I believe, always transcends historical truth. It doesn't make a bit of difference. I don't think George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. I really don't. But I think I don't want to stop saying he did, because the lesson that it teaches is far more important than whether he ever had a cherry tree or not. Do you want to say something on that?
No, this Garden of Eden is an extremely important item in our Judeo-Muslim Christian mythology, because as you could guess from the way I emphasized things, we have come up with lots of ideas of dominance and everything else that are not there. I mean, you take Genesis, the first word was mistranslated.
Yes.
Even. First word in the Bible mistranslated. It says in the beginning, and that isn't what it says in Hebrew. It's a conditional, when God began. And that construction is echoed again in the second account. So that all of this ex nihilo stuff that the Catholic and Protestant churches have evolved into a huge upside-down pyramid balanced on this tiny point is just blown away when you look at it and see what a thing really says. And this is why I wanted some of the things about what this decision, I won't call it transgression, of Adam and Eve was, and its connotations. I'm very pleased that you brought out some of the connotations of what this new looking at this thing carefully does to some of our ideas. They say it's it gets pretty darn basic as to decide whether people come into this world just plain evil because of something they couldn't help, and therefore everybody is candidates for our help. You know, we got a 100% audience. Or whether you think that man, being created by God, came into this world pretty good product.
Yeah. This brings up another issue, and this is just a personal thing that I have, not being a Mormon. Christians have the same problem with the Bible that I think Mormons have with the Book of Mormon. We have a tendency to canonize our understanding of Scripture rather than Scripture itself. And we never seem to get beyond that. I won't say any more. You all know what I'm talking about. But perhaps we ought to step back from exalting our understanding of things and try to hear what God is really trying to say. I've read through the Book of Mormon, and I've had to sidestep things I've read about the Book of Mormon in order to understand the Book of Mormon all by itself.
Any other? Yes?
Yes, the canonization gets reinvented also. That's exactly right. I am waiting. In my lifetime, I'm convinced of it, and I'm a young guy, you know, so I'm going to live to see this. I'm going to see one of the general authorities, a black woman, get up and say, it's time to have a truly contemporary version of the Book of Mormon so that everybody can understand it. And we're going to take out 1,100 and it came to passes, and perhaps... And perhaps 1,600 woes and yays.
Take the was, the ands out of the...
All of them have to go. Yes, the easy-to-read Book of Mormon. But I tell you what, I don't think it's smiled upon it in Salt Lake. I have one. I was sent a paperback copy. Lynn Anderson sent me a paperback copy of it some time ago. And I looked through it and I said, well, what's wrong with this? I know what's wrong with it. I can understand it. That's the problem. Toss it out.
Any other questions? I have a question.
Yes.
Implication is that the P account is really a priestly account. You can understand how that came to pass. What is the J account?
Okay, let me. Can I take that? Let me explain how that happened. And I skipped over it very quickly. King Solomon was, we often think of Solomon as one who was a wise person, who made wise decisions. Mm-hmm. He was also a rotten king. He was terrible. There was a time when he went, you know, Solomon, God denied David the opportunity of rebuilding the temple and gave it to his son Solomon to do. When Solomon built his own house, his own castle, he built it larger than the tabernacle. That's what kind of...
Took him 13 years and he spent 7 on the temple. So
amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just astonishing. The trees that he really wanted, the wood that he really wanted, came from the famous cedars of Lebanon. Unfortunately, the king of Lebanon wasn't on real good terms with the Jews. So Solomon made a deal with him and sold 10 Israelite cities and all their people into slavery to the king of Lebanon in exchange for getting these cedars, this wood. And this is what precipitated all the anger. Solomon also taxed the people terribly. You know, he had his 700 wives and 300 porcupines that he had to support. and he needed a lot of money. He taxed the 12 tribes. Every month, one of the tribes had to feed that crowd. And they didn't like that. So when Solomon died and his son Rehoboam was getting ready to take over, the elders came to Rehoboam and said, will you be nicer to us?
Take this yoke off our neck. Hmm? Will you take this yoke off our
yes.
neck?
Yes, and he said, I don't know. Let me go ask my teenage friends and see what they think. So off he went, and they said, are you crazy? What's going to happen to all the sports cars and the VCRs in it? They're going to be gone if you don't do these things. So he came back and he said in chilling words, which you can read in the Bible, my father beat you with whips, I am going to whip you with scorpions. It was just terrible. Of course, there was this big war. They separated. The two tribes to the south, Judah and Benjamin, were kind of lonesome at that point because the other 10 tribes broke off. But they had the temple. You see, they had the temple. And they continued in some reasonable way to worship Yahweh. The first act of the first king of Israel of the northern kingdom that broke away, his name was Jeroboam, and he was a former slave master to Solomon. His first act was to set up a false altar in the sacred cities of Bethel and Ai, which were at the in the northern kingdom. He put a golden calf, does that ring a bell, in each of these places, gathered the people, pointed to it, and said, "This is the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." It went downhill. Before the whole thing was over, the northern kingdom had 19 kings, and the Bible says they were all rotten, every one of them.
That was prejudiced account.
Oh, no, the Bible doesn't have any prejudiced things in it. Shame on you, Lou. The southern kingdom had 20 kings, and 8 of them were okay. Not a great record, but better than... But anyway, while the religions developed separately in the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, as they had to, the J account represents the developments in this southern kingdom of the people who had access to the temple and some nominal affiliation with the religion of Yahweh. The E account comes from the northern kingdom, you see? And it grew up completely differently. It uses a very funny word, Elohim. You know, that word Elohim is a very funny word because it doesn't really mean God in the way we think it. It can mean gods, plural. And in the Psalms, it's once translated angels. It's very nonspecific. They don't use the sacred name of God revealed to Moses at the bush. And by now I've forgotten the question.
Where did the J account
come from? The J account came from this nominally loyal group of people who remained with Solomon's descendants, you see, and they kept in touch with the temple and had, I think, a clearer view of who God was than he did in the north.
All right, so we have, but now we're saying we have three accounts. We've got the J account, the E account, which you've elaborated on too, yes. And the P account is separate from that. That's the priest's account entirely.
That's right.
So there are actually three accounts.
And then it's four. The Deuteronomist is...
Deuteronomist.
And then the redactor, who, by the way, most scholars believe was Ezra, the man in the Bible. So you really have at least five people, perhaps one of them a woman, as Lou said, putting the thing together. Okay, another question?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. It's an account in Genesis where it says, "And from this day they began calling upon the name of the Lord," is the verse. And that word is Yahweh, and it's very puzzling how they could do that if God had not yet revealed his name. Yes.
Part of the revelation of Yahweh.
That's right. It's the burning bush when Moses...
Was that Yahweh an acronym?
Okay, any other questions?
Was Yahweh
yes.
an acronym for he who causes to be that which is?
Yes, he's at UCSD. None of us knows what we're talking about. I mean, you know, the problem here is that this is not an exact science, and every day people are expressing their opinions. It's no different than anything else. Friedman is a very, very good scholar. There's no question about that, and all of his stuff is very good. But he frankly admits that he's not sure about all of this. He's proposing these things as possibilities, and the best you can do with anything that involves spirituality and religion is to claim things as possibilities. That's really the best you can do with a straight face and without crossing your fingers. You know. But as far as scholars go, he's an excellent scholar. He's one of my neighbors, one of the closer to Leonard. He's at UCSD. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know
yes.
that.
Right close to your house.
Yes.
The New Jerusalem Bible is a revision of the Jerusalem Bible, which was a French translation. It's also very good. It's a Roman Catholic translation with lots of good renderings and lots of good notes. I personally use the Revised Standard Version because I find it to be the most acceptable. I am about to start using a thing called the New Living Translation. You've all heard of the Living Bible, which is one of the worst atrocities ever imposed upon people. Tyndale Publishers is going through a revision process, and I was on the committee to revise Romans. We've just finished it about 3 weeks ago, and it looks good. It's actually a translation, and it's easy to understand. So if you ask me what I'm going to be using starting August 1st, absolutely positively the New Living Translation. But right now the Revised Standard Version remains the single most accurate and faithful rendering of the text that we have, unaffected by bias. As unaffected as you can be by bias. The new RSV, has some serious flaws, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think that gender inclusivity is a problem. I think it's good. You ought to have that. Where the Bible is not gender specific, you should not be gender specific. But there are places, especially in Ezekiel, where the new RSV changes the phrase "son of man," and in the Hebrew it is Ben Adam, which is not a and "son of man" is not a bad translation of Ben Adam in the Hebrew, and it changes it to "O mortal." All right? Now, ironically, in the New Testament, where Jesus refers to himself as a son of man, which is a reflection on the understanding of the son of man idea in Ezekiel, it retains the translation "son of man." So future readers will never make this linkage, which is an extraordinarily important linkage. And this is one of the main weaknesses of the new RSV. They blew it on that matter. There are other places where I thought it was simply unnecessary. When Paul says, "Once I was a child and now I am a man," well, unless he's a drag queen, then he is a man. There was no need to change it to "now I'm an adult." It was unnecessary. It's inelegant. Scripture should be read and should be heard elegantly. And when you start doing things where it's inelegant for no particular reason, I have a problem with it. So I do not use the new RSV, although my church uses it.
Any other things? Yes.
Oh.
Jeff, repeat the question.
Yeah, is there a good one-volume commentary for lay people? The answer is no. The closest you get, do you have a preference for a one-volume commentary?
No, I was raised on Goodspeed's commentary on the New Testament, of course. My introduction to the Old, to what we call the Old, was History of the Hebrew Commonwealth by Bailey and Kent, mm-hmm. which was a beautiful college text for.
I will tell you, and since we are out of time, I'll do this quickly. The best, the very best one-volume commentary you can get, these days you can only get at used bookstores and Christian Science reading rooms. They're the only ones that sell them anymore. And it's called Dumelo's one-volume commentary. It's a very good one. If you're looking for a multi-volume commentary, the absolute best is William Barclay's study series. Nothing better, and you can get them almost any place. The Jerome Bible Commentary is very good. Of course, it is a Catholic commentary, and it has a lot of bias in that direction. But it has copious notes and ideas about biblical criticism, which are very good. It's a good commentary. Okay, Strong's Dictionary or Concordance. Okay, all that does is cross-reference English words. And that's if you know the words in a verse and you want to look up the verse, Strong's helps you. If you want to know what the word was in the Hebrew or the Greek, it doesn't help you at all. You have to take what's called Young's or Englishman's concordances, and they will both be better than Strong's. Well, we're out of time, I think
we're out of time. We better quit.
Thank you
very much for both of you.
Thank you very, very much.